interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Well, it's 10:30 a.m., so naturally it's time for Film at 11 here on KBOO Community Radio, Portland. This week, we take an in-depth look at some important films and TV broadcasts. So we begin with Britta Gordon on some recent works of Steve McQueen.
This is the first time I'm recommending a show on Amazon Prime, and I hope cable listeners forgive me. Now, the reason I'm asking you to tap into this capitalist behemoth's entertainment offerings is British film director Steve McQueen's series, Small Axe. I've seen the first two episodes of this six-film endeavor. Each is a different story, and what links these films together is their focus on the Caribbean, also known as West Indies, community in London. Beginning in the 1960s, sometime after the first immigrants arrived in the 1980s, and spanning about 20 years. If you've seen any of McQueen's films, Hunger, Shame, 12 Years a Slave, you will probably expect intensity, if not ferocity, actors who commit to their roles with almost disciple-like zeal and a willingness to take on almost any kind of subject matter, notably sexual, but political most certainly as well. McQueen's film Hunger forced Michael Fassbender to subtract himself almost to a skeleton in his depiction of Bobby Sands, the IRA activist who died on a hunger strike in prison. In 12 Years a Slave, Fassbender went to actorly extremes as well in his portrayal of a slave owner tortured and thus torturing others by his lust for one of the slaves on his estate. If I mention these two films, it is because they set up an expectation that is intriguingly fulfilled in different ways in the two very different films here. But they have many things in common as well. They are films about the Caribbean community in London, how that community interacts, comes together, and fractures. Mangrove, Episode 1, centers around the newly opened Mangrove restaurant, whose proprietor, Frank Critchlow, is making a fresh start after a past that includes endeavors such as gambling rooms. Portrayed by Sean Parks, Critchlow's long and mournful face takes on the contours of a Caribbean Job as a series of police raids, headed by a brutish bully named Pulley, wreak havoc on his popular space and the regulars who have come to see the Mangrove as a home away from home. As played by Sam Spruill, Pulley's racist comments and gleeful egging on of his fellow officers put the lie to any notion that British police officers, though they traditionally did not bear arms, were any less violent or vengeful on a population they hated and feared than their American counterparts. The plot of Mangrove evolves as young intellectual activists in the Caribbean community start to see the Mangrove as a locus for their awareness raising. They persuade the reluctant Frank to stage a demonstration, the result of which is that nine of them, including Frank, are put on trial, charged with riot and affray, serious charges that potentially carry heavy prison sentences. The last part of the film is a breathtakingly suspenseful trial in which the accused face a courtroom of, no surprise, a powerful and dismissive white male establishment. They rely on an eager young lawyer, played by Jack Lowden, whose demeanor and wig kind of call to mind Mike Myers and Austin Powers. But a few of them, with the encouragement of the lawyer, decide to defend themselves. Mangrove grabs you right away, as McQueen, using close-ups and warm, dim lighting in the restaurant, makes you feel as if you were part of a scene. At times, it actually seems to move interminably slowly, perhaps because you get so close to every action, every development. As painful as real life, even more so because the slow meeting out of injustice, drip by drip, is truly felt. There are a few missteps. One of the crusading couples bickers about who will take care of the baby, a scene that feels pat in a film that otherwise strives to include women as forceful actors. The defendant, Darcus Howe, played magnificently by Malachi Kirby, who begins to take down Pulley and his lot via pointed questions, is more than matched by his ardent activist colleague, Althea Jones, played by Letitia Wright. Oddly, the divisions between men and women in that community seem muted in this film, especially by comparison with episode 2. And it's interesting to note that Frank Crichlow is portrayed as having a young white lover, a young woman we've seen briefly at the beginning and who is never portrayed as attending his trial or indeed any of his important moments. These kind of things feel like odd elisions, but they're things to note at this point in the film cycle, not major objections. While the second episode, called Lover's Rock, centers almost exclusively around a house party, it is equally charged and observant of the ways in which the personal quickly become political, even amongst members of the same community. The film uses a fairly brief framing device. Martha, played by Amara J. St. Aubyn, is shown escaping out the window of her home, shoes in hand. She's off to meet her friend Patty, played by Shaniqua Akwak, for an evening at a house party in which neither of them know anyone. From the outset, this episode focuses on the youthful, likely second and third generation Caribbean Britishers, and is far more concerned with delineating male and female roles than Mangrove. The men set up sound equipment and are the DJs of the entrancing reggae music that floats throughout the film. The women cook up a storm in the kitchen to prepare, although we never seem to see anyone eating anything. They sing to each other. As people arrive at the party, the women dance with each other and the feeling is anticipatory, although a bit wary given the men standing around on the sidelines. It's joyful. Gradually, the action roams the rooms and out of doors as men and women begin to make tentative connections. Then it's back to the dance floor and the music and atmosphere become decidedly more erotic, less playful. Martha finds herself dancing with Franklin, played by Michael Ward, whose dignified but determined charm pry her away from Patty, who leaves the party a bit later, apparently upset at her abandonment. As Martha runs after her friend, she's confronted by the neighborhood white boys and rescued by Franklin. You don't have much time to worry about Patty, though I did, because we're back at the dance floor and Martha and Franklin are now a couple. McQueen spends a lot of time focusing on writhing midriffs, and there's an almost endless sequence in which the participants sing along with one song well after the music has stopped. Most interesting is the sequence in which the men take to the dance floor. The music and activity become far more aggressive, even violent. I thought of certain ethnological films I've seen, such as Jean Roucher's Les Maîtres Fous, which concern possession. Something close to possession is happening in this room, and it reminds you that in many of McQueen's films, there's a kind of ferocious, snarling beast that inhabits his characters, and by implication, all of us at times. Lover's Rock refers to a kind of romantic reggae, but one of the best things about this film for those unfamiliar with this musical genre is how wide-ranging the selections are. Sweet, sexy, comic, angry, and even experimental. The music seems to bend time at that party and makes you feel as you likely would as the hours go on into the morning, as if things might never end. There's not much plot in the film as such, but as in Mangrove, the underlying plot or animating theme might well be described as this is worth watching. These lives are worth watching because they happened in this way. Did you know? This is fascinating enough, just this moment in time and these vibrant, hungry young people. And McQueen is right. It absolutely is. I think most white watchers will likely need to turn on the subtitles on these films. I certainly did. That's also so you can just allow yourself to fall into the lilting musical cadence of Caribbean English speech, which is almost like perfume. It's so viscerally beautiful. I can't wait for the next four films. If ever there were a reason to get Amazon Prime, and believe me, I'm not advocating it, this series is it.
Thanks, Britta. These sound like must-see films. Let's turn next to our Los Angeles correspondent, Jeff Godsell, with another essential of cinema, in this case, an autobiographical tale that came at a key transitional moment in film history.
When Federico Fellini's Armacord was released in the final weeks of 1973, international cinema, or at least its exhibition in the United States, was seeing the beginning of the end of its golden age. Many so-called art houses would be closing their doors or turning into multiplexes. Distribution and financing for films was changing, and many of the foreign filmmakers of the Golden Age, the Antonionis and Truffauts and Bergmans and Kurosawas, were thought to have left their best years behind them. Even the title of Fellini's film, Armacord, or I Remember in Italian, suggested a look back, perhaps with nostalgia. But the truth of it was that Fellini had always been using his memory and his imagination as the inspiration for his films. For Armacord, he merely focused it on his own hometown of Rimini in northern Italy, located along the coast of the Adriatic Sea. And Fellini, being Fellini, you just knew that this reminiscence would be a fanciful, outrageous, visually splendid journey. In Armacord, Fellini revisits his adolescence, but chooses not to insert himself as one of the characters. Instead, his true life best friend from the day, Tita, has a prominent role. But this is not to say that Tita is anything like a protagonist or expected to carry any kind of moral weight in our story, such as it is. Gone were the days when Marcello Mastroianni would assume that role in Fellini masterpieces like La Dolce Vita and 8½. Now, Fellini would take a mostly non-judgmental, but still withering look at the past and his place within it. The town of Rimini in the mid-1930s, still in the early grips of the Mussolini era, is nothing if not lively. There are festivals in the town square, everybody's got an opinion, and everybody's a character. Despite the circus atmosphere and the appearance of a cooperative community, the citizens of Rimini are actually constantly at odds with each other, hurling insults and openly gossiping. If far less realistic than Fellini's earlier look at his hometown in the classic I Vitelloni in 1953, perhaps Armacord is even more truthful. Although he was hesitant to clarify it in interviews, preferring the films to speak for themselves, Fellini, especially in his later films, used exaggeration and broad satire to explore deeper truths and firmly held beliefs. Fellini has sometimes been criticized for stereotypical depictions of women, as if Fellini was merely celebrating their objectification. But a closer look at Armacord reveals a pointed satirist at work. Behind all the swinging fannies and oversized breasts is a weak and ineffective patriarchal society, propped up by tradition perhaps, but clearly rendering the male youth of Italy ill-prepared for the demands of their impending manhood. By all accounts, many of the characters are based on real figures from Fellini's childhood and adolescence, including Volpina, the town nymphomaniac, and Gradisca, the grande dame of Rimini and the object of so much desire. And of course, Miranda, Tita's mother, the true head of the family, over the blustering father and the pampered sons. As entertaining and frequently hilarious as all of this is, one can't help but feel the searing edge of Fellini's satire. These characters are victims of their own desires, of their provincialism, perhaps of their very culture. And they are also guilty of the complacency that allowed fascism to come to power in Italy. As a youth, Fellini could never take Mussolini and his minions seriously. They were clowns. And in Armacord, the fascists are portrayed as such. Dangerous, but ridiculous. Mussolini's very arrival in Rimini is preceded by a lot of cheering and a cloud of smoke. Armacord would be Fellini's last great success, that is, being liked by both critics and the public. It would win all the expected awards, including the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. It would also feature another great score by Fellini's longtime collaborator, Nino Rota. From the first bars of the opening credits, you just know you're going to be in for a ride. Armacord is available on a double disc from Criterion, which features some priceless interviews from Tita himself and many others who remember Fellini well. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Jeff. This is Film at 11, Friday morning on Community Radio KBOO Portland. And now let's hear from Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time on a British horror TV show that took his fancy.
Right now I'm watching The Frankenstein Chronicles, starring Sean Bean, set in 1827 in the Regency period, post-Napoleonic War era. John Marlett, former soldier, is now sort of a special investigator attached to the Bow Street Runners, a forerunner to the Metropolitan Police. And he's been assigned to find out who's put together a body that was stitched together of the corpses of children. And along the way, he's come across this book, Frankenstein, by Mary Shelley. And so he goes to a reporter who he's met, who uses the name Boz, which is actually Charles Dickens' pen name at the time. And he asks him about this book that he just read, this book, Frankenstein.
You know that?
Frankenstein. Who doesn't?
Me. Tell me about it.
You didn't see the play? Edmund Peake's performance? 3 or 4 summers back, that season's hot ticket, until Parliament shut it down.
Why is that?
Blasphemy. It's about this madman who finds a way to resurrect the corpses. The whole world went twice, except you, badly. Set off quite a trend for a while.
Trend for what?
Mothers giving birth to serpent children, people turning into wolves at midnight, that sort of thing.
Which came first, book or play?
Book, of course.
What do you know about the author?
Mary Shelley, one of Byron's crowd. Rumlot. You've heard of him, surely?
No.
The vampire lord. Poet. Seducer. Traitor.
Traitor?
Speaking up for Boney, as I recall. Don't know much, do you?
I fought against Bonaparte at Waterloo. Not that much.
One of the many clever things about this show is the casting of Sean Bean. He kind of brings you into the drama in a characterization that's very reminiscent of his character Richard Sharp in a TV series that he was in about 10 years ago as a rifleman in the Napoleonic Wars. And this character seems to be in a continuation of that. Very nicely done. Very literate script that mixes fictional characters with historic people as well as situations. So this setting at the early days of modern society, where you're establishing standardized medicine and a responsible an organizing a responsible police force, and that's the background for the story about a mysterious madman who's trying to copy the work of this book, Frankenstein. Very nice mystery, very nice characterization. Once again, I kind of like British shows because it's like grown-ups in charge. And so that's the Frankenstein Chronicles. Pretty good for binge watching. Stars Sean Bean, and it's set in the Regency period. There's 2 seasons, 6 episodes per season. Enough time for the drama as well as the puzzle. So that's the Frankenstein Chronicles on Netflix.
Thanks, Matthew. And now for our book corner, I'm going to take a glance at one of the key volumes of film criticism published last year. One noticeable phenomenon of recent years is the tendency of writers to go easy on older films. By the lights of contemporary film buffs, no bad film was ever made and no DVD resurrects unworthy films. This attitude may please publicists and DVD stores, but does a disservice to criticism and the arts. By contrast, here is V.F. Perkins on the state of British cinema in 1962. In Britain in 1957, on a limited budget with a script little better than that of the average horror picture, and in spite of some awful effects work, a director of no prestige but enormous talent made one of the finest occult movies we have ever seen. In other words, Jacques Tourneur made Night of the Demon and offered us final proof that, however frustrating it may be, the British industrial system is not in itself a sufficient explanation of the badness of British films. So how can we explain it? Primarily, we would point to the general climate of opinion in Britain, and in particular to the British concept of the good film. The traditional British quality picture follows a recipe for which the ingredients are an important and, if possible, controversial subject, race, prejudice, the idiocy, inhumanity of war, the dignity of the individual, etc. A popular story, a fair representation of all points of view, a resolution which makes the audience think, a cinematic treatment, and last but more important, a few personal idiosyncrasies, in the hope that mouthpieces will thus resemble people. Now, if this looks like the formula for The Bridge on the River Kwai, so much the better. Kwai is the picture which almost all the old guard directors would most like to make. It is also the direct product of a critical environment, of the belief that it is best the cinema offers a good story well told. This article appeared in the first issue of the magazine Movie. Though hard to look up because of its very title, the magazine still appears in online form, and at the time, several fine writers appeared in force in its pages, including Robin Wood, Raymond Durgeant, Ian Cameron, Michael Walker, and many others. Among them was Victor Perkins, who went on to write a book for Penguin called Film as Film, which put into practice the magazine's standard of close readings of Hollywood movies. But that was his only book for many, many years, and to find his other writings, one had to scour numerous film magazines and scholarly journals. Now, posthumously, appears V.F. Perkins on Movies, edited by Douglas Pye. The book contains some 40 pieces, each with a source citation of its first publication, a list of books and movies mentioned in the articles, and notes by the author or the editor. And it soon becomes clear while reading this treasure trove that the directors who mean the most to Perkins, or which offer up the best material for elucidation, were Hitchcock, Renoir, Welles, Otto Preminger, Nicholas Ray, Cukor, Minnelli, and perhaps, above all others, Max Ophuls. Thus it comes as a shock when the unlikely final essay in the book is on Frederick Wiseman's documentary High School. But here is a near random quotation from an account of two then-recent George Cukor comedies. Cukor is established as the one director who is nowadays willing and able to film song and dance with real excitement. No musical since The Pajama Game has offered anything as enjoyable as Marilyn Monroe's My Heart Belongs to Daddy, or even the Let's Make Love duet. The numbers are shot in Cukor's post A Star Is Born manner, splendid color and lighting effects, a camera which glides with the slick elegance of a Sid's Charisse, and a brilliant use of small areas of the wide screen. It never suggests that the director would have found the old 3x4 ratio more congenial. Cukor is almost unique in his avoidance of the backstage musical's most obvious temptation, the expansion of the numbers into production routines, which would look cramped on the stage of the Colosseum. The dances in Let's Make Love are the more effective because they could quite conceivably be produced in a small off-Broadway theater in the round with a minimum of stage props and an efficient lighting system. One of the most sought after of his essays, at least by his fans, is called Moments of Choice, and it originally appeared in a now obscure, defunct magazine called The Movie, that took as its project a history of the movies recounted in successive issues, like an encyclopedia, eventually gathered into a set of 6 books edited by Anne Lloyd. The essay appeared in the volume about the 50s, and it's probably the best brief introduction to what a film director does, while also debunking a few misconceptions about the studio system. The essay begins with an examination of why Orson Welles staged a sequence from The Magnificent Ambersons in a mammoth refrigerated building. Quote, "There is an answer, and it is visible on the screen. In sub-zero conditions, unlike those on a hot sound stage, the breath of players and ponies freezes in the air to a visible vapor. That is an important effect, since it goes with the soft, white landscape to which the scene felt as one of natural purity. The sharp freshness of its air, made present this way, provides an all the more telling sight for the appearance of the horseless carriage. Here, in a scene whose nervous jollity is only touched with foreboding, it is a joke that the vehicle sullies the countryside with racket and filth. But there is nothing frivolous about the contrast between the heavy black fumes of the machine and the silvery human breaths that vanish on the air. It states the vulnerability of the complacent small-town aristocracy to the impact of a new technology." Here's another quote from that same essay. It's a close reading of a motif in Nicholas Ray's gangster movie, Party Girl. One minor instance is the choice of props. At the start of Nicholas Ray's Party Girl, chorus girl prostitutes are paid for their services at boss Rico Angelo's party with a gift of powder compacts. The glittering compacts are discarded as soon as they have been emptied of the $100 bills inside. Later, Rico, played by Lee J. Cobb, settles accounts at a presentation dinner for his ambitious underling, Frankie Gasto, played by Aaron Saxton, by beating him about the head with a gold-plated miniature pool cue inscribed "From Rico to Frankie." And at the film's climax, Rico's threat to disfigure the heroine is teasingly developed as he unpicks the tinsel and tissue wrapping from a bottle of acid. Throughout the picture, then, elaborate gift wrapping serves as a cover for payments, bribes, assaults, and threats. Ray presents an image of gangland Chicago as a world of disguise, whose characters are constantly hiding the true nature of their transactions, from themselves as well as from others. The props are one means through which he is able to remodel a fairly routine gangster assignment into a film about pretexts. For Perkins, as for Truffaut in his film Day for Night, directing comes down to decision-making. Films are the product of decisions, and at the same time, often hinge as narratives on decision-making. As Kristen Thompson has shown in her book Storytelling in the New Hollywood, movie narratives come in four parts, or acts, or large-scale segments. And one can also add to that formula that the transitions between these large-scale sections comprise decisions made by a central character. By way of illustration, there is a key moment in The Godfather. Youngest son Michael visits his father in the hospital, only to find that the man has been set up for assassination. He whispers to his father, "I'm with you." And the meaning is doubly dense, for he instantly takes control of the hospital situation, averts the hit, and shortly thereafter, during a contentious meeting of the sons and their advisors, Michael calmly lays out a plan for revenge for the attempts on their father's life. He recounts his plan, and Coppola slides a slow track in on Michael's face to set off the speech from that of the others. Of course, they laugh at him, the protected son who didn't want to be part of the family business, but soon they see the sense of the scheme, and Michael assures them that it is not personal, it's just business. Well, he may well believe that, but when he decided to tell his father that he was with him, it now means that he is part of the family business, after all. Well, that's all a side issue to the book itself, but it does show how V.F. Perkins and his essays can lead to deeper appreciation of just how movies work. Again, the book is V.F. Perkins on Movies, edited by Douglas Pye, and published by Wayne State University Press at 510 pages in trade paperback. Well, that's it for now. Until next week, when Film at 11 once again appears at 10:30 a.m. on Friday the 15th, here on Community Radio KBOO Portland.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laisse tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Entraînés par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, nos deux mains restent soudées. Et parfois soulever nos deux corps enlacés s'envolent et retombent tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux.
This is MF Grimm. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This feels like home being here. Keep hip hop alive.
Camp is in session. Join us at the KBOO station on Friday, May 7th.